I, Liberty, Chapter 12. It's like being born again, sir.
Well, you've been gestating long enough in the womb of London Town, said Barrowbridge.
He was feebler now and hard to hear when one wasn't used to him, but then one was. The old mind, however, was crisp and clear, though subject to surprisingly sudden fits of slumber, sometimes only a minute or two long. He had no longer any particular sleep period, but read and slept, slept and thought, talked and slept, as it came to him.
"Sit down and tell me all you've done, lad. My, you look as if you've paid sixpence for a ruby and found it to be a diamond."
"'Twas threepence, sir, and the diamond as big as your head," said Lance exultantly. "Well, I've been to see our old friend Meadows," he laughed.
"Tried to scalp you, I warrant."
"Ah, no, he's over that. He's living in two rooms over a tannery in Camden Town, and searching for the meaning of things."
"On what road?"
"He says all the universe and all the years are but a hand's breadth away from us, and you care to see all of it at a glance, you need only to open the casement. Ha! To open this window, you place yourself in a small room with dark hangings and no light and no air. Light a brazier, throw on some dried leaves, and lie down before it until you are half dead with the smoke from it. And in this condition all knowledge is at your disposal. He finds it impossible to recall what the knowledge is after he comes out of it, but he's sure he recognizes it at the time, and goes back and back after it. He forgets to eat. Perhaps he means not to. He did say that eating and sweating and such intrude upon the higher self, and he never goes out but to fetch more leaves from the Lascars down at the docks. Ganja, they call it. Wisdom weed. It smells like old rope to me and catnip. I thought I'd find him too stupefied to do anything with thinking of opium and such, but he surprised me. His thinking is wild as ever, but perfectly clear. Perhaps more so, as I discovered when I got him decently dressed and over to a private room at the Fish and Staff, and packed him full of good English mutton and ale, which he ate submissively enough but uncaring. Strange thing, his body starving and his mind not knowing it. I explained to him that it was in his power to right the wrongs done to him, and his cousin Charles, and his dead uncle Evelyn Pierpont, the Duke of Kingston. I don't know that righting wrongs, even wrongs done to him, is a subject of interest to the lad, but the pacification of his tormentors definitely is, and I think the idea of gaining the approval of his disgusted cousin Charles pleases him very much. Riches for himself, vengeance against that very blight of a woman. These seem not to reach him, but when I painted him a picture of Charles, wringing his hands and saying, 'Well done,' why, he wept onto his mutton chops. And when I explained to him that the action I had in mind would require nothing from him but his signature upon various papers, that he probably would not need to testify or appear, for the entire case rests on the documentary evidence, why, he was overjoyed.
And he did not question you as to your interest in the affair?
No, not he. I do believe he lives in a world populated by but three classes of people, those who do things to him, those who do things for him, and those who leave him alone. The last are the ones he likes the most, and his greatest wish is to include all of humankind in it. Any action which adds the class of persecutors to it is an action he favors. As to the few who do things for him, he feels humble and unworthy and grateful. If he thinks about my motives at all, it is only to regard me as a mystifying clever chap who goes about righting wrongs out of the greatness of his heart, using methods he would not presume to understand, he laughed.
Mind you never begin to see yourself in that light,
Barrowbridge cautioned.
And so he agreed, eh?
That he did, and then and there signed the identifications of self and total charges. I carried him back to his catnip temple. I then did all the necessary things at the court and the office of the clerk. The suit is begun. Even now, a rider is off to Lainston to take in charge the parish record for 1744, and a package is being made of the Duke's marriage records, the proceedings of the suit for Jack Dictation and everything else relevant, including, of course, a dispatch of information to the Duchess and a command to return, which she won't do.
Have you signed anything yourself?
Not a dot. I have a faceless little chap called Briggs, who is just barely a member of the bar, to send my messengers about. He'll voice everything on behalf of Evelyn Meadows.
Aye, that is wise. The new Earl of Bristol isn't going to be happy about this, testifying at the House of Lords, to which he's only now had entry. That, after those years of being cuckolded, he did collude and perjure to remove the nuisance. Should you be identified with such a humiliation, you'll be hard put to sidle up to him and say, "Love me, da."
He'll not find out. How could he?
Just take care. And so the case is come up?
It couldn't be stopped now. Her Grace Elizabeth, Duchess of Kingston, shall be summoned to stand trial for bigamy, will certainly refuse, will be tried in absentia, and certainly found guilty.
Lad, don't make a habit of using the word certainly, but I do think you're right. What else do you prophesize?
The Kingston marriage must be voided with by the verdict, and her title with it. The title becomes extinct, the estate goes to the cousin Meadows, the now valid marriage to the Earl of Bristol succumbs to a divorce for adultery, which must be brought and shall be granted. Aye, and at a stroke, and at the end, we shall have a crushed and sorry Bristol to be consoled by a dutiful son. And, he said slowly and with the greatest pleasure, an obliterated Elizabeth Chudley.
"Do ye hate her so much?"
Bearbridge asked. Lance answered with a sound, a snort, which said more about hatred and scorn than Alexander Pope could have said in a lifetime.
"Aye,"
said Bearbridge, nodding as if to a statement. Then,
"So far, lad, so good. Things should indeed come as you say. She married Bristol, and you have the proof. She married Kingston. Between the two there is merely a rare and perjurious action. 'Tis bigamy, and no mistake. She must be guilty. As to the Earl of Bristol, I credit you with fine insight. Were ye to go to him now with no proof of yourself but your Hervey's face and your Chudley schemes, he'd jettison you to-day, as he did when you were but an unwanted proof of an unwanted circumstance. But appear and stand by him when he's sick with humiliation. Call him father and honour him, and I do believe you can win him over. 'Tis a pity you haven't a speck more substance, though. Long lost son or no, you're still a penniless claimant to a sizable estate."
"Ah, but I thought of that,"
cried Lance's exultation returning.
"What if my wife were daughter of a baronet, with a nice little holding and a bit of gold coming to her?"
"Ah-ha,"
said the old man appreciatively.
"I see what you're up to, ye sly scamp. You wouldn't marry Miss Eustace to elevate yourself to the level of the Gregorys, but you would to elevate the Gregorys to the level of earls."
"Or so it will seem. But the marriage will be for love, and the elevation will be my secret until the time comes to come to the aid of yon poor, broken earl."
"You're a credit to all my wickedness,"
chuckled the old man.
"Tell me now what I needn't ask. Why did you proceed with all this before asking my thoughts?"
"Have I done any of it wrong?"
"Did I not say I needn't ask? Nay, you're right all along. Fiendishly so, eh?"
He closed his eyes for a space, in that swift sleeping of his. Lance waited patiently. With his eyes still closed, Barrowbridge said,
"I suppose I was trying to make you say you needed me no longer. Now why should I want to hear that?"
"Ah, sir," cried Lance, but the old man did not move again, nor speak. So he shrugged and left, smiling. As always, he was warmly received at Minden, Bella and Barbara dancing about him and plaguing him with little attentions until shooed away by Elaine, and Sir Gregory emerging from centuries past to grant a sherry and a moment's conversation to the younger man.
"How do you fare with your work, sir?"
Sir Gregory gave a pleased grunt.
"Bit proud of it. Never done with, what? Decent history of Rome. Almost finished. Deuced lot of work. Years. Well, worth it. What?"
"I picked up something that might be of help to you, sir. Source, you know. This chap's done quite a bit of research, I think."
And he handed over the just-published quarto he had picked up in London.
"3 more volumes being printed now. I've ordered them for you."
"I say, good of you. Oh, yes," said the baronet,
peering at the book, turning it over, opening and leafing through it.
"Yes, indeed. Look this over, what?"
And he went into his sanctum again. Bella, the obedient one, had already towed Barbara away, and he was alone with Elaine. She smiled and came close.
"You're so good to father."
"And why not? Everyone should be."
"What was that book?"
"Oh, something they'll be chatting about in the city just now. Haven't looked at it myself, but since it concerns Rome and so on, I thought he might like it. A chap called Gibbon, yes. The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. But enough of dead things, my dear."
He took her hand, and they sat together on the sofa. She was in pink this evening, such a pink as should have gone badly with her red-gold or gold-red hair, but which was enchanting instead. She had an extraordinarily fine neck. He noticed for the first time as she turned her face away and down. He caressed with his eyes the clean, straight lines of the tendons to their hollowed junction below her throat, and the petal pink of ear so shyly hidden near the upper end. He reached out with his free hand and touched the ear. She did not move away, but closed her eyes so that the lashes lay right down on her cheek.
"I think," he said in a voice full of astonishment, "that I have never seen you before."
Not looking at him, she said,
"What has happened to make you see?"
He laughed, mostly at the thought of telling her what was happening.
"I've been dreaming," he said, "and I think my dreams will come true."
"Who is in your dreams?"
"Ah, fine folk, lands and castles, and ships of gold."
He looked through the ceiling at some heaven of his own, and chuckled richly.
"Brocades and masquerades, and a great stable of blooded nags."
He was finished, and she made a little disappointed sound, but she turned to him and smiled.
"I'm glad your dreams please you so."
"Once upon a time,"
he said suddenly, warmly taking her other hand,
"there was a young prince who was put under a spell by an ugly old witch, and it made him invisible. He walked about and did things, and went to places and saw things, and felt that he was alive, but really, you know, he was not, because when anyone looked his way, they saw nobody. Just nobody."
"Is there a princess?"
"Oh, most certainly there's a princess. She had golden hair, and her eyes... her eyes..."
"What about her eyes?"
"A wonderful thing. They were both exactly the same color."
"Oh,"
she said petulantly, and in mock anger snatched away her hands, but she put them right back.
"And the prince went one day and saw that the wicked old witch had lands and treasures and castles and all the things I was dreaming about. And so he made a great magic when the old witch wasn't looking, and poof! She was punished, and no one ever heard of her again. And so he took all her lands and castles, and everyone could see him.
"Oh,"
she said. "What's the matter?"
"I don't think I like your dream."
"Why not? It's a lovely one."
"It hasn't anything about the princess in it."
"But he married the princess."
"Did he?"
"Doesn't that please you?"
"I expect it does, all right. He was greedy."
He laughed immoderately. "Aye, that he was, and a good thing too, else he'd still be a nobody." He looked at her and sobered. "Can't it please you? What shall I add to it to make it please you, Elaine?"
"I'm silly,"
she said, and tried to laugh lightly, making instead two silly little squeaks. At that she blushed, and again he had the strange sensation of having never seen her before. "Tell me," he begged.
"Oh, I thought the princess would love him truly, and one day she would wish for a prince, and kiss her wish, and poof, there he would be, right by her, where he had been all along."
A most amazing sensation came to him. It felt like shame, and if it was, he was incapable of understanding why. It certainly felt like it. He pressed it away and asked tolerantly, "How do you kiss a wish?"
"I don't know. I expect you just..."
What happened? What happened? It was a tease, a small thing, a nothing, and she closing her eyes and her lips to show him some childish something, and this blaze, this coruscation, arms full of, mouth full of, break, burst, spill, crash, silence. Breathe. God, he would say. But God was a word, and he could not say a word. He held her and stroked the nape of her neck while she cried. She sat up suddenly and looked at him, and he said a very strange thing. He said, "I was 14 in the garret, and 1,000 times since, and never this, not once." He saw in her eyes a knowledge of what he meant, though he himself hardly understood or knew. The knowledge he saw in her eyes was passed in an instant. It seemed like the knowledge Meadows had spoken about, that he found in his draped, fuming room, known utterly at the time and inexpressible thereafter. She put her hand on his mouth and took it away, and put her other hand to make a cup on her lap. She sat looking down into it while he rose quietly and left without a word. All the way back to Featherfront, he looked up at new stars with new eyes, and the only articulate thought he could command in all that time was, "But a kiss did that?" On the eve of the trial, he went to see the lawyer Briggs and secured copies of each indenture, affidavit, certificate, and instrument pertaining to the action, and carried them all home for Barrowbridge's inspection. He was followed from London by two horsemen, which was unpleasant. Once he told himself, "But I'm not invisible any more," and was irritated at the thought. This was no time for whimsy, and then he began to think they were highwaymen, which made him think of Piggott, which unaccountably angered him even more. But when he turned in at the path and climbed the first slope, he looked back and saw them canter past, going straight on toward Tatsfield, and then he laughed at himself for a fool and forgot the matter. This was a time for happy moments. Barrowbridge gave him one after another when he'd seen the papers. It was only a grunt and a shake of the head. He had not a word to change nor a suggestion to make, just a caution.
"Do not let a whisper of your part in this get to the Earl of Bristol, and you've not a thing to fear."
Suddenly he flung the papers upward with a shadow of his old great shout and said,
"Lord!" he cried, "what a structure! What a retribution! You could rack the old bitch and never hurt her so much as this, and all so safe, and all without her even daring to defend herself."
He looked at Lance with fond amazement.
"I lie here sometimes and wonder what I've been spared for by rights I should have died when I said I did in Bermondsey. I'll never think that again. I've lived for this, and I'm happy."
Lance was embarrassed. "Ah," he said, shy as a pipit,
"Meadows thinks I'm put here to make people happy too."
The old man chuckled.
"Ah, yes, Meadows. Have you a plan for Meadows? 'Twould be a shame to waste all the Kingston estates on him."
"I shall scan them. Mayhaps there'll be a townhouse or a bit of a manor which I might wistfully covet, and he might gratefully deed to me. He will have his opportunity."
"If wistful you must be, let it be for lack of a block of high rentals round Grosvenor."
"Mr. Barrowbridge," Lance said abruptly, "I'm in love."
"Taw!"
"I am, sir, truly."
"The blind archer at last! Do you know what Cupid confers on his victims, Lanky?"
"Madness, they say," smiled Lance.
"Blindness, Lanky. His own blindness."
"But it's Miss Eustace, sir. Don't you agree that a linkage with—"
"'Tis not the girl I object to, nor the plan. They're both exquisite. A strange thing about the wonderful Jesuit Balthazar Gracian is that his oracular contains not a single maxim about love and courtship. In a specialist on worldly wisdom, this seems a dreadful oversight, but the penetrating mind will discover that it is not. It is indeed the greatest part of his wisdom."
"How so?"
"Why, it is his way of saying that the wise think so little of love that they think of it not at all. If I presume to add a maxim to the oraculo on the subject, explaining this, I would say—"
He closed his eyes and slept, or seemed to sleep. Then he opened them and continued.
"Would say, when considering marriage, look first for love. If it is absent, proceed. The moth in a room of 1,000 lights sleeps safe on an unlit candle."
Shocked, Lance cried,
"Why, she's the most—"
But Barrowbridge was asleep. Lance gathered up the papers and went away. A shepherd's crook and a bony sturgeon swung in the bright noon sun over the entrance to the Fish and Staff. It was full of fine folk on such a day, eating the splendid food and drinking the good ale and old brandy. 'Tis a day of largesse, thought Lance, for the first time in his life tossing a silver sixpence to a beggar. 'Tis a day of brightness and certainty, marred only by one's inability to be a fly on the wall of the House of Lords, watching the progress of humiliation, seeing the penstrokes sending disaster away to Italy and the enemy, searching the newest earl's face as it crumbled under the blows, and was softened for the aid and comfort he would build for it as meticulously as he had designed these wounds. He paused and looked down the street where a corner of Parliament toasted in the sun. Was it started? Was it over? Would it take all day, and adjourn, and take tomorrow, while the business of America waited, while the disasters of Rockingham, the stubbornness of George III, the balanced forcefulness of Pitt, and the balance it forced from Fox, would all these matters wait on him through today? Through the week?
"Ah, Parliament," he exulted. "The next time I sway you, you'll know it's I."
He would sit with the Prime Minister over a glass of port one day, he thought, and he would say,
"Remember the day back in 76, and the trial of the false Duchess of Kingston. You were there, were you, and saw it? Ha! Now let me tell you what really happened."
From the direction of Parliament came a great closed coach. Yellow, struck golden in the sunlight.
"I shall ride in such a carriage," he thought.
He stood on the walk before the Fish and Staff and watched it come. From his left he heard his name called. He turned. From the Fleet Street corner came a lady, and a... why, it was Sir Gregory Eustace. And in a pale sack, Elaine. He raised his hand, and to his amazement saw the baronet stop dead, shaking his fist. He saw Elaine turn to her father, clasp her hands anxiously, then suddenly run from him, to come tripping down the street toward Lance, holding out her arms. From his right he heard his name called, and he whirled. The great coach was almost opposite now, its doors swung wide. Its passenger held out an imperious, bejeweled hand to him. He turned again. Elaine's face was pink with exertion, and something else. It was twisted as a face so fair and dear should never be. He took a step toward her, but from across the road,
"Here!"
In as chilling, as self-competent a command as had ever been flung at him since the early days with Barrowbridge. Spellbound, he stepped off the curb and crossed the road, and it was as if fear had been there all his life, not born of the moment at all. Fear curled tighter in him than the spiral of a butterfly's tongue, fear now springing out and across his belly, slashing him inwardly, for he knew that face. Reflexively, he took the extended hand.
"Milady!"
"Sir, your grace!"
"Your grace!" he said faintly.
Because he held the hand, and because one did, one must, he kissed it. Behind him on the walk, anguished,
"Lance!"
From the coach.
"Get in,
son."
He got in the coach. The door slammed, and the wheels rumbled. With the sound, the near cataleptic numbness left him, and fear took over, drying his mouth, capturing his lips and cheeks, knotting his stomach with a great, empty ache. So crouched he there, his eyes drawn down to glistening slits, as through their squeezed, captured tears, they tried to see the magnificent menace seated opposite. Faintly,
"Lance!"
came through the window unheard. A glimpse of pale blue unseen. Then the world was shrunk to these rumbling walls, and the presence of terror seated so close that it seemed to touch him knee to knee.
"Well, I'll be damned,"
said the Duchess. His vision cleared, and at last he saw her. He wished he could see a Hervey now, so that he could understand the admixture, but that was a detail. His mirror henceforth could tell him who his mother was. She said,
"I confess this is a moment I've dreamed of since I was summoned, and in the dream you have crawled, you have wept, you have fled, you have fainted. I never thought to find you smiling."
He said nothing.
"Perhaps Lily was right in her preoccupation. Does it please you to learn that she would speak of you daily, if I permitted it, that she has written you 7 letters, which I have had to intercept? I should listen more to Lily."
She had a strange voice, different. Different how? Well, different from one would have expected. He knew her as resourceful and shrewd. He had coupled softness, mellifluousness, with these. Therefore, he did not expect this brassy quality. Her voice, like a Bermondsey barmaid's, her diction pure as an archbishop's. It shocked, it transfixed. She said,
"Are you going to persist in using one of my own best tactics, and remain silent until you can command the situation?"
He bent his head until his lips were in his puffed scarf, and tried to wet them with his tongue. It was too soon. She observed this sharply and made a mistake.
"Very well, then, smile. I shall give you the situation exactly as it is, and defy you to command it."
I am just come from Lord's. It is over. All over. It took under 2 hours. You are a fool, boy. You're the cleverest fool I've ever known, and there may be hope for you, and perhaps ignorance of the most important piece in this pattern does not quite qualify you as a fool. I'll give you that. You did not know because you could not know what passed between me and Bath in the old days, between me and Hamilton, and Winchester, and Bishop Irvy. Huh, even Bath was astonished to find out about him. You don't know what passed between us, and you couldn't know what was left. You could have known, however, how they all feel about Oggy. I should say the Earl of Bristol, your honoured father. Ah, you should have found out about that first. Perhaps you're a fool after all. Know then that I walked into the Lord's at 10 o'clock this morning, after quite the busiest 2 days of a very busy life, and whom should I see first but my dear old coxcomb Bath, surly and gout-ridden, but with the old devil still alight in his eyes. She chuckled. It's in Camara, old girl, he says, and takes my arm. Come along with me, and bless you, it's good to see you again. And in I went to the green chamber, comfy as ever, with a bright fire cheerful on the hearth, and all my old loves ranged about the room. I tell you, boy, it was the jolliest reunion of the jolliest people on earth. We sat about in that cosy place for an hour or so, playing Remember When, and confessing to each other little secrets we kept all these years. At our age such things lose their harshness, and mellow like Madeira. That was when I asked them to send for Winchester and the Bishop. When they came in, it was jolly all over again, and at last we came down to brass tacks. This stupid business of this stupid Meadows is the way Bath referred to it. The fool has us to rights. Those deuced documents, you know. We must do something about you, Lib, darling. You're a ruddy menace. She tapped Lance's knee with the hard tip of a forefinger. You can push Parliament to do a thing, you see, but you can't stop them from doing it their bloody way. I shall make it brief. Under no circumstances were they going to make a house performance of this matter, partly on my behalf, bless them all, and partly because they really like Oggy. They were not going to force him to get up before the world and confess to his difficulties with me, and his poor bumbling perjuries in the Jack dictation action. He wasn't even there, and for good reason, but I'll come to that later. They asked me if I intended to stay in England. I said I did not. That was splendid. I shall go abroad, and stay abroad, and it shall be called Agreed Exile, and to the title, since it expires with my death in any case, there is no objection to my using it even up until then. I deprive no one. Again the hard finger. As to the estates, it may be technically true that bigamy makes my second marriage a nullity. However, so airtight and iron-bound is that magnificent will that you, dear boy, helped draw up, that the estates are mine because I'm me, and not merely because I am Duchess of Kingston. This adds weight to my keeping the title, for I have the estates. The only thing which remains to be settled is the matter of my properties here in England, which in my tragic exile will be useless to me. I am therefore giving them all to my dear Lily Axelrood, who has, after all, been a devoted helper and assistant to me, and deserves a change and a reward, income sufficient for their upkeep and a bit over with them. The rest of the money will, of course, come to me. You wouldn't believe how quickly these things were settled down there in the Green Chamber. Oh, well, Bath had them all drawn up, knowing everything and knowing me to boot. All I had to do was nod my head and laugh with him. And at last he told me, as a sort of afterthought, "By the way," he says, "we shall have to punish you for this bigamy thing. Says so right here in the law. Brand your pretty hand." And with that he takes a horrid, spitting mull-iron out of the fire and brandishes it about, dropping sparks on the carpet. He glares at me with those devil eyes alight, and plunges the iron straight down into a mug of ale he has ready. "Libby," says, "it's neither the season nor the time of day for mulled ale, but do you take a swig of this while it's hot, and drink to our health, and let us certify you're branded." So I did, and I kissed them all, and promised them to clear out of England as soon as I had my affairs taken care of. They wept a bit, and that was that. I'm satisfied. Are you, boy? The coach rumbled on over the cobbles, while Lance sat passive. Her words rested on his mind like snow on a cold kiln, waiting to melt down. At length some of his preoccupation left him and vision returned, and he found himself looking at his hands, a jiggle on one knee. He realized that he had been staring at them for a long time. He raised his eyes to his fellow passenger's face, the first half of that quick flash of inspection one flicks at a stranger, hoping it will be unobserved, knowing that if one meets the stranger's eyes, one will look away and fumble something. He met her eyes, and there his glance was arrested. In that moment he met one of the most compelling qualities of this woman. In his way Barrowbridge had described it, and so had Pigott, he found that he could look straight at her, for as long as he liked, taking whatever he could. She did not hypnotically capture his attention snake-like. She did not present that detachedness which sometimes makes it possible to inspect a new face and not be touched by it. She gazed back with neither warning nor welcome, but with perfect frankness. Here I am, all of me. Here is fire, here freeze. Walk where you choose and take the consequences. She smiled a little and said, "Would you care to leave me now?" "Yes," he said. She nodded. "That's the first word in converse you've ever spoken to me, and one to remember. I shall expect you to use it again." She made a disenchanting change in the smile, and vanished it, and said, "You may not leave me now. I have one other matter to discuss. I've been in England for 3 days, but even before I arrived, I knew you for what you are, and I knew what you had done. Do not be mystified. You might have reasoned it for yourself. A charge of bigamy smacks of proof, and proof could only be the Langston Parish record, and that smacks of Barrowbridge. And lo, I meet you again. I had your half-mask of an unknown lawyer Briggs located and bribed even before I set foot ashore, and thereafter it was not difficult to divine the balance of your plan. The bastard who was not a bastard by birth, who became a bastard by his own machinations, who could only want to legitimize himself, and there was only one way to do that, and that was to legitimize his parents' marriage. I don't hold against you the fact that of several ways to do this, you chose the most vindictive. In your position, I should have done the same, or worse even. In my position, however, I can't tolerate it. Anyone who has ever caused me discomfort must pay threefold. Except for you, my boy, who caused me discomfort by the very act of being born, and who continues to cause me discomfort by drawing breath. So you pay tenfold. Recognizing that your only aim in this matter could be the Bristol heritage, I took the trouble to go to Ickworth in East Anglia and visit my, let us say, your father. That relationship is somewhat less diffuse. Augie has become a very distinguished gentleman, and like many weak men, has a streak of angry stubbornness when properly aroused. Seeing him was not easy. He would not admit me, and so I had to go round the house and march in through the terrace windows and confront him. Then it was some minutes before he understood that while he was saying I should not be there, and that he wanted no intercourse of any kind with me, my relatives, or my retinue, I was warmly agreeing with him. When I could then, I informed him briefly but completely about you, who you are, who you claim you are, your vital part in the suit of Jack Dictation and marriage, by which, in freeing himself of me, he so jeopardized his good name, and your present action. I also predicted in detail your only reasonable move after this was to appear before him as a long-lost son, with his face in my scheming persuasiveness, and so manipulate him that he would pay for his humiliation by rewarding you with his estate and title. She laughed gently. It was intriguing to see just how furious Augie Hervey, the third Earl of Bristol, could become. I was sure for a moment he would fling himself down upon the carpet and scream. When I left him, He was hard at work on a letter to his barristers arranging for a categorical disinheritance of putative and potential heirs de corpore suo, known, unknown, to be known in the future, together with a complete alienation of his title from his property, so that in the unlikely event that you should so convincingly prove your identity that you succeed to the title, it will carry with it not one penny. Only a petty man can be quite so meticulous. Only an angry man could carry the thing quite that far. Your father is petty, and he's an angry man. Disappointed, dear? He turned his head slowly and stared unseeing out the window. Her words still mounted on his mind, which was shocked beyond absorption. They would stay there until it was too weary to keep them down, and they would come plunging in. Deep down he knew this, and it terrified him. Abruptly the carriage stopped. He turned to her again, startled, and found her gazing interestedly at him, her magnetic head a bit to one side, and her eyes excessively bright. "I think you were wise to be so silent. You've given me no words I can ever use against you. I feel like I could have you talking like a jackdaw if I put my mind to it, but I choose not. I do not like you, and cannot. I confess, however, that I admire your shrewdness and your ingenuity, and I'm all agog, really, to find out what you will do now. I hope it will surprise me. Whatever it is, you may be quite sure I shall know immediately what you've done. Think of me with you always, like a bright-eyed bird on your shoulder, knowing all the details of all you do." She made a quick gesture, so fraught with command, that he obeyed thoughtlessly and opened the door. "Even," she continued, "to the location of the particular public stables where you have left your horse." He swung his head dully and looked and saw she was right. He put one foot upon the step and felt her tug his sleeve. "Do get yourself baptized," she said warmly. "It will save your soul, if you have one, and it will give me a name to call you by. You haven't one now, you know, for all your legitimacy." He surged up, and she caught at him again. "I think you shall not see me again," she said very gently. "Say goodbye. It will make a difference," he thought. But he could not know what difference it would make, exactly, nor if it would be a difference that he could want. He leapt out and crossed the walk and went briskly into the stable. He heard the coach rumble away while he was asking for his horse. He doled out his syllables, being careful to miss none for all his divided attention. He waited with his back to the doorway until his animal was brought, then mounted and wheeled and rode out toward Westminster Bridge. If he had any thoughts between London and the Downs, he could never thereafter recall them.